Good morning, Killarney Park. This is Neil Graham. I have the privilege of speaking to you today. We will be studying Mark 5, 21 to 43. I asked Jen to send out an outline of the talk with passage broken into eight scenes, with a few questions to think about and a little space for you to make a note. Hopefully many of you will have some time been able to meditate on these scenes and make some notes. This will facilitate discussion later. I will make a few comments on each scene as we go along. As some of you will remember, I like to discuss biblical stories by imagining we are there in the scene itself, or into a number of scenes that we see where Jesus is working or teaching, and then sort of think of ourselves as taking pictures of it or a video of it, and thinking how to capture what's really going on in each scene. So if you've had the outline, please make it available to you. Otherwise, open your Bible to Mark 5, 21 and follow along. I've broken the portions into eight scenes. We will comment on each one as we go along. Scene 1. When Jesus had again crossed over by boat from the other side of the lake, a large crowd gathered around him while he was by the lake. Imagine you are making a video of this scene. What would you focus on? What would you think would be the main point that you want to communicate? I think that, first of all, there'll be a great sense of anticipation. Jesus is returning to his side of the lake, near Galilee and Nazareth, his hometown. So let's take some pictures of people talking rather excitedly and pointing to the boat coming in. It's like, let's get a panoramic shot from the boat. Holy moly, everybody's here. Crowds are on tiptoe and they're almost pushing each other into the water. Everyone's trying to get the best shot, the best view of Jesus and right close to him. Jesus has been very busy when he was on the other side of the lake, and large crowds gathered means there was no room in the waiting room for people. Everything was crammed. Everyone was trying to get close to the spot where he will land. Access to Jesus is extremely limited. Everyone is jostling to get close to him. Everybody wants a piece of him. Scene 2. Then one of the synagogue rulers named Jairus came there. Seeing Jesus, he fell at his feet and pleaded earnestly with him. My little daughter is dying. Please come and put your hands on her so that she will be healed and live. Who is this man? What does he want? What does his face look like? What's going on for him? How does he get in front of Jesus in the middle of this tremendous crowd? Well, we know that Jairus is an influential man. He's a devout Jew. He is the head of the synagogue locally. He organizes worship services. He's in charge of who speaks. However, he is not in charge now. It's really true for all of us that illness that comes particularly suddenly is something that absolutely interrupts our life and makes us aware we're not in charge. So he is pleading with Jesus to help him and the family. He prostrates himself in front of him, a sign of desperation and respect for Jesus. He is pleading with him to come and help him and heal his daughter. He probably needs courage too, because they're already an investigation of who Jesus is by the authorities. The lawyers have come from Jerusalem. The Pharisees in Galilee are already very critical. He is risking his own career for his daughter. So he pleads earnestly. He believes Jesus can heal his daughter. Please come and put your hands on her so that she will be healed and live. This is a publicly spoken prayer. Jesus' reputation for ability to heal is on the line. Jairus is praying and believing not for himself, but for his daughter. Lots of times we pray for other people. Sometimes we pray for ourselves. I've often found it really hard to pray for myself. He's apparent in great pain, and there's some fear on his face, I think. He's afraid of the worst. The scene ends with this lovely little statement. So Jesus went with him. A large crowd followed and pressed around him. Let's remember that authorities are already planning to destroy Jesus. And so this is a difficult time. They will be watching. In contrast with the Pharisees and the lawyers from Jerusalem, we see an example here of a leader who has faith in Jesus, and Jesus responds to his faith. So they go towards Jairus' house, and so does the whole crowd. They're crammed around him and jostling him. They anticipate a great story to tell. They were there when it happened. And now we realize that in scene three, there is another story within the story of Jairus and his daughter. And that story starts with these words. And a woman was there who had been subject to bleeding for 12 years. She had suffered a great deal under the care of many doctors and had spent all she had. Yet instead of getting better, she grew worse. When she heard about Jesus, she came up behind him in the crowd and touched his cloak because she thought, if I can just touch his clothes, I will be healed. Immediately her bleeding stopped and she felt in her body that she was freed from her suffering. Imagine the woman's emotional and physical state as she tries to get close to Jesus. She is obviously going to be frail. She is older. She's been sick for 12 years. So she has a chronic condition. She had at one time a sum of money, perhaps from inheritance or perhaps from her dowry, but she is now absolutely broke. After paying many doctors for many years and after paying for her treatments, she just got worse. She's out of money and she's out of hope. She lives on the corner of despair and helpless. She's kind of out of options. She heard about Jesus healing people. She doesn't want to be seen by him or anyone else. So she crowds behind him where she can remain anonymous. She's convinced if she just touches him, if she can get to his garments, she'll be healed. She's a tremendous example of someone who believes in spite of all her own troubles. Unlike Jairus, she doesn't ask for healing. She just simply wants to touch him. She doesn't need to ask. She wanted to be anonymously healed. If I can just get my hand through this crowd, nobody but me will know. It worked. She knew right away, and she was healed. Scene 4. At once Jesus realized that power had gone out from him. He turned around in the crowd and asked, "Who touched my clothes?" "You see people crowding against you," his disciples answered, "and yet you ask, 'Who touched me?'" "Who touched your clothes?" "Thousands of people have touched your clothes." "Lord, if maybe you got hit by an elbow in the face, we'd know how to do contact tracing by seeing who hit an elbow and is holding on to a sore elbow. But touch your clothes?" Why is Jesus so insistent about this? It says he kept on looking for who had done it. The disciples make light of the question. "Are you serious? We are totally unable to keep any kind of social distance from hundreds of people, and yet you want to find out who touched your robe?" At this point, I think it would be good to sort of see the village streets that they were going through. They're heading to Jairus' house. They're very narrow streets. There's a huge crowd, and there's simply no way that they could actually figure out who touched him and who didn't. So we have crowds. We now come to scene 5. Jesus kept looking around to see who had touched him. Then the woman, knowing what had happened to her, came and fell at his feet, and trembling with fear, told him the whole truth. So she comes just like Jairus in a way. and prostrates herself at his feet. Why is she so afraid? She trembles because she's afraid that she's made many people ritually unclean by being close to them. She has been bleeding for so many years. Everyone knows that she is unclean and that she will make anybody that touches her unsuitable to worship God until they're ceremonially cleansed. She has been regarded as dirty and dangerous for close to half her life, probably. She was the cause in the Jewish leaders' eyes of the equivalent of what we would call a worship pandemic, a pandemic of dirtiness. The temple and even the synagogue were out of the question for her to attend. And wouldn't you know it, the leader of the synagogue happens to be right in front. She should never be in this crowd. They all knew her condition, and they would be furious with her for endangering their purity. No wonder she's afraid. But here is the beautiful thing. Jesus lets her tell her story and let everyone know that she was healed. Jesus listens to our story. It's a wonderful thing that he does. And she gets to publicly talk about her healing. And then he says that her faith has healed her. It seems to me that Jesus is so persistent in trying to find out who touched him, partly because her illness has been so persistent for 12 years. He matches, in a sense, his own persistence against the persistence of the illness in her. Thank the Lord that he cares that way and that he really lets her know that he understands her story and that she has actually been healed. He's going to confirm it for everybody. So Lord, the Lord hears our unspoken sighing prayers and he wants to hear our story. Tell him your story. Ask him to help you in your story, to bring healing out of your story and joy in the midst of it all. The person who never gets into the synagogue has more faith in Jesus' mind than the people who go regularly. And everyone hears that she knows she has more faith than they do. So instead of expected condemnation, she instead hears Jesus call her daughter, a member of the family of God. And he commends her faith in him and says, go in peace and enjoy freedom from suffering. He is not afraid to be touched by her. She is one of the touchables now. She's gone from being an outcast to being declared a family member by Jesus. So she gets far more than she was hoping for. She is not just physically healed. She is restored to the family of Israel and to her Jewish community in front of the synagogue ruler, who is in no shape to complain about this. He is in the same trouble himself. So Jesus summarizes publicly what has happened in the scene. He said to her, daughter, your faith in me has healed you. Go in peace and be freed from your suffering. Jesus has brought freedom and wholeness to a marginalized woman. However, before we go on to the next scene, let's ask the question, if you're Jairus, how are you feeling at this time? As he has watched this scene with the woman play out, is he totally impatient? Is he fearful it's too late? Fear always challenges faith. He cannot wait any longer while Jesus talks with this frail, sick woman, who, according to synagogue policy, he knows shouldn't be here. He's the head, he's the president of the synagogue, for heaven's sake. And she's had the nerve to make Jesus unclean. Jesus should not now lay hands on his daughter. She'll make Jesus unclean too. How is Jairus doing? He's thinking, oh no, Jesus is now not eligible to touch my daughter for the rest of the day. The synagogue leader would know the rules. He has asked Jesus to lay hands on his daughter, but now his hands will be unclean. Of course, they're going to be unclean anyway if his daughter dies. He because touching a dead person makes you unclean ceremonially as well. From Jesus' point of view, the woman is on equal level as the president of the synagogue. This is a lovely feature. He simply cares for people of every part of the social strata. Don't you love him for it? Scene 6. While Jesus was still speaking, some men came from the house of Jairus, synagogue ruler. Your daughter is dead. Why bother the teacher anymore? What would be on Jairus' face now? What's he thinking? Sorrow, anger, sadness, fear. Well, it could also be maybe hope. I've been wondering about this. What's really on his mind? Because he has just seen Jesus respond to a desperate woman's faith and be healed, and an act of great mercy. I'm sure people often wonder why Christians perceive and believing when prayers are not answered right away. Jairus has seen the healing of a hopeless person. So we can understand if he thinks, well, he's done it for this woman, a wonderful act of grace. I think more than ever, based on experience, he'll do something gracious for my family. I think I'll just keep on believing. I'm sure many of us could answer the question, what experiences of Jesus have you had that keep you believing? Share some. I can remember many when I was young, particularly. What's the attitude of the messengers from Jairus' home? Don't bother him. The Greek word means don't harass him or trouble him greatly. It's over. She's dead. How do you think Jesus responds to this comment about him, not to be bothering him? I think he's got a look of compassion and determination. Maybe a little bit mad. He just keeps walking with Jairus. I will decide what bothers me, not you. It's time to ignore spectators. You are not in charge. Keep on believing when many doubt. He tells Jairus to keep. Ignore the crowd. Focus on me. Don't let others decide what I care about. Verse 36. Ignoring what they said, Jesus told the synagogue ruler, don't be afraid. Just believe. It's time to ignore the crowds. They are just a distraction. Jesus does see some fear in Jairus' eyes and probably great sadness welling up in him. So he calls for him not to give up. Don't let fear destroy your faith. Keep trusting him. In effect, he's saying, rely on what you just saw today. You've seen me heal someone already. Don't let the skeptical crowd define what you think will happen. His daughter's healing is going to happen, but it will just be delayed. I think all of us know what it's like to have delayed answer to prayer. Sometimes for years. For the lady, it was 12 years. But she kept on believing. Verse 37. He did not let anyone follow him except Peter, James, and John. Why? Jesus is not looking for publicity or to do miracles, for show on demand for the unbelievers who want entertainment. And he also wants space for parents and a few disciples. In every emergency story we see on TV, the same thing is said to the crowds of onlookers. Get back. Give the doctor space to work. This is serious stuff. It's not for your entertainment. Back up. Back off. Do not be a distraction, and do not distract the one who is going to actually heal the person who's ill. Scene 7. When they came to the home of the synagogue ruler, Jesus saw a commotion with people crying and wailing aloud loudly. When people died in Israel, mourners, sometimes professional ones, but also very close friends, would arrive even before the death of someone, or at least as soon as possible. And they would wail and cry for a long time to give voice to the family's grief and loss. I used to think that crying at funerals and crying over the death of someone or the serious illness of someone was kind of not very helpful. You weren't being helpful when you cried. I now believe that actually it helps a lot. It helps people who are not able yet to express their grief to see that others really cared and that they really loved and that they are really concerned for you. So it's not inappropriate for us to mourn and to mourn out loud. We can mourn out loud, and that does not hurt people. It can often help. There would also be preparations for burial done quickly because of the heat in Palestine. So it will be all over fairly quickly. Scene 7. Jesus went in and said to them, "Why all this commotion and wailing? The child is not dead, but asleep." And they laughed at him. "Ha! Are you kidding? I know dead when I see it." The mourners become laughers. They think that Jesus is crazy. Scene 8. How does Jesus react to their laughter? After he put them out, he took the child's father and mother and the disciples who were with him and went in where the child was. He took her by the hand and said to her, "Talitha kumi." In Aramaic, the home language of Galilee, the terms meant, "Little girl, I say to you, get up." Immediately the girl stood and walked around. She was 12 years old. At this they were completely astonished. He gave strict orders not to let anyone know about this and told them to give her something to eat. This last scene is a beautiful scene. What strikes you about it? I have about 9 things that I can see in it that really moved me. Number 1, it says, Jesus put them out. He tells the laughers to buzz off. How do you think he does this? Well, why does he do it? This is no laughing matter. The mourners will not be needed. He wants social distancing. Okay, you guys get out of here. You're in the way. 2, Jesus is moved by their faith and wants the mom and dad to be there so the daughter won't be frightened. The first faces she will see when she rises will be mom and dad. Isn't that a tender thing? And a lovely thing about Jesus. He doesn't even want to be the center of attention himself at all. It's actually the daughter's parents that need to see her, and she needs to see them. 3, the parents know what her story will be. Their daughter was healed by someone who is greater than the law, someone who can rule over life and death. The disciples as well are on a journey of discovery who Jesus is. It's a wonderful characteristic of Jesus that disciples get in on faith-building exercises and experiences. It would be encouraging for us sometimes to share a faith-building experience we got in on, a time when we were actually startled by what God did. I can remember now quite a number. The disciples, in spite of their failures, will get in on some wonderful scenes. 4, Jesus touches the girl. Now he's really unclean, technically, because she's dead. The leader of the synagogue will realize Jesus is Lord of life and judge of what is clean or unclean. As Paul says in 2 Corinthians, "For our sake, Jesus became sin, who did not know sin, so that we may be made righteous." In effect, he became unclean so we could be made clean. The language, of course, of this whole story is Aramaic, the heart language of people in northern Galilee. And when Jesus says, "Talitha kum," to the girl, she will understand what he has said. He's talking her language. Isn't it great the way the Lord does this? It's tender. And he says, "Rise and shine, sweetheart." She's 12 years old, we're told, the number of years the older woman had suffered her illness. I don't know what the significance of that is, but it's just for some of us, our healing needs is quite immediate, and for some of us, it's a long time. Then he said, don't tell anyone about this. He means it. He doesn't want to be a celebrity entertaining the crowds. This is called the messianic secret. My time is not yet come, is what he says in other places. He will be revealed in a short time when he is lifted up on the cross and raised up from the grave. But not yet. Don't bring this on quicker than it needs to happen. In the meantime, the family is going ballistic. The daughter is walking around and skipping. The slightly doubting disciples have their doubts challenged. It's a scene in which there is tremendous joy. But the story ends in a lovely fashion. As Jesus says, his ordinary comment to the parents, she's not a ghost. I think she needs lunch. And you can see Mom starts to make lunch with a big smile on her face. The story began with hundreds of people crowding around and pressing Jesus and the disciples. The passage ends with six people in a small house, Mom making lunch, a scene of peace and joy. Jesus has brought peace and joy to a suffering family. Again, the kingdom of heaven is at hand. Thanks be to him. Don't you just love the way Jesus works with people and with you? Perhaps we should share at least one of the scenes that we really love in this story and why we love Jesus because of it. Thanks be to God.